This is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire. It's time to talk politics again. While there's some reprieve from the Australian bushfire crisis this week, rising from the embers are questions for our politicians, and there is no longer any willingness to accept the response, now is not the time. Carbon emissions, hazard reduction, the role of the Commonwealth and the states, where the Australian Defence Force fits in, it's all on the table now. On Sunday morning, Prime Minister Scott Morrison sat down for an interview with David Spears on the ABC.
People, for the first time, I think, arguably, have wanted to see a more direct involvement of the federal government in responding to these national disasters. Now, that's relatively new, and that was not something that was recommended going into this fire season.
The Prime Minister's rhetoric over the weeks has shifted, especially on the role of climate change in exacerbating the crisis. But Mr. Morrison is still firmly against introducing a price on carbon. Welcome to part four of our summer series on climate change and weather with Peter Hannam. We've tried to keep the politics out of this special series, but it's been such a turbulent time for the government that it's only fitting we bring in David Crowe, who is our chief political correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Peter Hannam and David Crowe, thank you for joining Please Explain once again. Peter, can I start with you, please? Can you start by giving us a rundown of where we are at this week regarding the fires?
So as of the middle of January, I think we're almost like literally in the peak of summer in terms of the time. We're halfway through. And I think with the rains that are expected to come across, certainly into New South Wales, we'll probably have seen the worst of the fire in that state from around about now. So I think if you look at it, we're about 5.2 million hectares burned in New South Wales, probably about 1.5 million hectares in Victoria. Those are the two states that have been particularly active fire-wise. Of course, South Australia too has some fire risk. But I think we're starting to see the fire season work its way out. It's been moving down from Queensland really since September. And I think the focus in the next few weeks will continue to be Victoria, perhaps South Australia and maybe Tasmania. But in the most popular state, New South Wales, we're probably past the worst.
Earlier this week, the New South Wales Rural Fire Service Commissioner announced that that big Gospers Mountain mega blaze had finally been contained after it had been burning since late October. What does contained mean if it's still going?
Well, there are definitely parts of the landscape that will be still smouldering. The rains that we'll get in the last couple of days of this week should put some of them out. But you're talking about, you know, 512,000 hectares at last count for the Gospers Mountain fire. So when they say it's contained, I suppose it's looking really at the perimeter. As far as the fire authority is concerned, they think that it's probably not going to extend from where the kind of footprint on the landscape. It'll be parts within that perimeter that will continue to burn, but it's not likely to be a kind of a threatening fire for properties within that region.
So we've definitely had a reprieve on the fire fronts this week. The people of Melbourne probably don't feel like they're out of a crisis just yet, given that the day we're recording this podcast on Wednesday, they're experiencing the second worst air quality in the world. The organisers of the Australian Open and the Kooyong Classic are trying to work out whether or not those events can continue because the air quality is so bad. Why is the air quality in Melbourne so bad this week?
So this is particularly the fires in East Gippsland are circulating back over Victoria. And the smog and smoke that had been occasionally touching Melbourne previously had come from New South Wales, where the fires are mostly out. But the rains that are expected probably won't put out the fires in northeast and eastern Victoria. So there's still a chance that going into the Australian Open, there'll still be occasional, depending on the winds, occasional days of bad smoke, which would be pretty bad for the tennis.
So David, in the first month of this fire crisis, the political rhetoric was defined by politician after politician standing up and saying, now is not the time to talk about climate change or emissions reduction or hazard reduction or anything to do with these fires. We have reached the point now where this crisis has gone on for so long, and perhaps because of the slight reprieve, that that is no longer an option, is it?
What really happened is, to use the analogy of the fires themselves, it couldn't be contained. I mean, the initial political response to the bushfires was to limit the debate, focus on practical things that could be done that day or that week, and contain the broader argument about political options, and that became unsustainable as the fires went on, as we saw Canberra itself completely shrouded in smoke, and then that was happening in other cities as well, it was impossible for Scott Morrison to limit that argument. Now, at no point during this did Scott Morrison deny that science was a part of the fires. I mean, he's the image of him walking into Parliament with a lump of coal.
Speaker, this is coal. Don't be afraid.
Don't be scared. The Treasurer knows the rule on crops.
It's coal. It was dug up by men and women.
I think does damage to him over time, but he has not denied the climate science. But his language was much more passive about the problem in the early stages of this crisis. And I was just looking at one of the quotes from November, you know, and this is what he said.
These are things that were very well known to the government. I mean, it's the contribution of these issues to global weather conditions and to conditions here in Australia are known and acknowledged.
I find it interesting that it was very passive in some of those stages. It's now much more active, and that's a change that we've seen really in the last week, particularly with that weekend interview on the ABC where he talked about things he wanted to do, and he talked about going even further, that's his phrase, on emissions reductions, about doing better and better and better, that's his phrase, on emission reductions, but also talking about adaptation and resilience, preparing for climate change.
Oh, look, David, I've set out very clearly what the government's policy is, and that is to reduce emissions, to prepare our resilience for the future, and to prepare our adaptation. That is the government's policy, and this is important because there is a lot of division being created in our community based on a false premise. And the false premise is about what the government's actions and policies are.
So that does suggest some policy action in the future. It is interesting, though, that it's very difficult for the government to get the language always right on this and to communicate exactly what it's doing. And after that interview, Morrison's office did clarify that he was not talking about a more ambitious target to reduce emissions by 2030. And that was really important because sometimes you can read too much into some of these remarks and think that they're going somewhere where they're not. And for his own backbench, and for the unity of the government, it's pretty fundamental that he can't be too ambitious on the 2030 target because then he's opening up a can of worms in his own party room.
So speaking of his own party room, Science Minister Karen Andrews was on the front page of The Herald and The Age on Wednesday saying, "Every moment we debate about the role of climate change in these bushfires is a moment that we are wasting in taking action." That's pretty strong language out of a party room that for the last 10 years has been completely riven by this issue. What's your sense of where the party room is on this in recent weeks? Have they shifted?
I don't think that there's a big shift in the numbers within the party room. There's a shift in the mood, and I think that there's impatience with some of the more conservative voices. There's a member of the Liberal Party, Craig Kelly, who gets a lot of attention because he will always speak publicly about his concerns about climate change. He's sceptical. He's rubbishing some of the talk about the contribution of climate change to these fires, and he gets a lot of airtime, even on the BBC.
And if you look at our science, if you look at the long-term rainfall records in Australia, there is simply no trend. As CO2 has increased,
all right,
there has been no
trend.
That's because other MPs are much more guarded about going public at the moment. Those who do want action on climate change are more reluctant to speak, and that's because they don't think it would be helpful within the party room if they spoke up now and were then vulnerable to accusations from their colleagues that they were using the bushfires to push their own barrow. But I think there's quite a number of them. We've seen some go public in their own way. Katie Allen, a Victorian MP, was on Facebook saying she was really encouraged by what Scott Morrison said on Sunday and she wants action, but she's not going on the front page of the newspapers saying that. So I think Karen Andrews, the science minister, was not just speaking for herself, but speaking for other MPs as well, with that impatience about, I guess, the sceptics, which is a relatively small group in the party room, like Craig Kelly, the sceptics who are pushing back against change. The message from Scott Morrison is that there will be some policies in this space.
You're listening to Please Explain. We'll be right back after this.
From the team that brought you Phoebe's Fall and Wrong Skin comes a new 10-part investigative podcast.
Motor Vessel Pong Su, I intend to board you.
I thought to myself, this is this f***ing boat.
The Last Voyage of the Pong Su is a story of drugs, cops, espionage, military, death, a dictator, and mateship.
Flag of my honor is Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
150 kilos of heroin had never been imported before.
These people, they expected to be executed.
It's a dead person.
Holy shit.
Search for The Last Voyage of the Pong Su on your favourite podcast app.
Peter, the states are either going it alone or talking about going it alone. Victoria has announced quite ambitious emissions reduction targets of its own. How does it work for a state to have targets that may be competing with federal targets?
All of the states and territories have a net zero carbon emissions target for 2050. So all of them are pointed, if you like, not necessarily with policies. That's coming in Victoria. We'll see them after March. But they're all pointed in that direction. So arguably, if all the states were to meet their targets, then the federal one is also met too. At a federal level, there is no formal sort of post-2030 target, although Australia, as a signatory to the Paris Agreement, kind of has an implied net zero in the second half of the 21st century. Individually, you've got states like New South Wales, a Liberal National Coalition-led state, setting its own target now at minus 35% of 2005 levels by 2030. They are saying that they can actually get that probably without trying very hard. That's possibly why they set minus 35. Labor in New South Wales had gone to the last election with a minus 45% goal for that, which was more in line with federal Labor, if you like. So look, individually, states are going to come up with their own policies. Under the sort of pre-Kevin Rudd years, the Howard years, as they were known, there were similar sort of state-led efforts, which once a carbon price was introduced by the government of Julia Gillard, then the states more or less folded their plans into that national scheme because there's no point having that kind of double up. But in the absence of national goals, states coming up with their own has, you know, it's, if you like, better than nothing, but in some cases will have odd outcomes, certainly less efficient than if there were a national kind of set of goals. And that's, I think, what we'll start to see, maybe pressure again for something like a national energy guarantee. We see that was Malcolm Turnbull's sort of pet project with Josh Frydenberg. He's been talking about reviving that. Several of the states, including New South Wales, had been backers of that too. So without necessarily lifting the Paris goals that Australia have signed up to, there will be greater pressure, though, to show what policies actually are in a federal space, reducing those emissions. And we don't have much at this stage.
David, Scott Morrison has ruled out a price on carbon. Why is he so wedded to that position?
That is sort of the litmus test for the conservative flank within his own party room, and it's a river that they feel they cannot ever cross. The trouble is just how all-encompassing that veto becomes. I mean, when the National Energy Guarantee was being debated in 2018, Malcolm Turnbull putting it forward, it had majority support within the coalition party room. But its critics, including Tony Abbott, saw it as a de facto price on carbon because deep within that mechanism, there was a way to put a value on the emissions that were being reduced. And that veto becomes so sweeping that barely any policy can pass the test because sooner or later, you are trying to put a value on those emissions and trying to reduce them. But Scott Morrison, for peace within the party room, can't go there. It's not quite clear where else he can go at this point. I was talking to a Liberal MP about the National Energy Guarantee the other day, and look, this is somebody who supported it in 2018, but doesn't think it's going to come back, doesn't think it can. The moment's passed. Scott Morrison's position after he became leader was that the NEG is dead.
What was his position when it was being negotiated?
That the NEG was worth doing. He was a supporter of the National Energy Guarantee up until that leadership crisis of August 2018, as were most ministers, as were most backbenchers. I've got the minutes of one of the backbench committee meetings where there was overwhelming majority support for the National Energy Guarantee and a small group of MPs, including Tony Abbott and Craig Kelly, who spoke against. But that moment, according to the people I'm talking to, has passed. So they've got to look at other ways. One of the challenges that they've got, another MP admitted to me quite frankly, is they've never spoken about climate change with conviction. People don't believe that they really mean it. So constituents for this MP, who's in a city electorate, don't believe that there's real meaning when they talk about climate change in terms of delivering hard policy. And I think that's something that they really do have to overcome. And the only real way they can do that is prove that they do have some answers. At the moment, it comes down to what Angus Taylor, the energy minister, is talking about in terms of a technology roadmap. We will hear more about that in the coming weeks and months, but there'll be a lot of expert commentary on whether that actually stacks up.
I want to talk about hazard reduction, because at the moment every single person in Australia is an expert on hazard reduction. Peter, can you explain to me, please, who makes the decisions about when a hazard reduction burn is conducted and where?
So basically, this is not a federal issue really much at all. So it's down to the states and, in fact, down to the communities. So, for example, if you were in the Blue Mountains National Park area, there are lots of towns in there, then, and you wanted to seek hazard reduction in your area, that means some kind of controlled burning during the cooler months when there's not so much risk of the fire escaping and damaging property or threatening lives, you would put up a proposal and say, you know, we need to do this in this area. And so the local rural fire service with the council would typically have a look at what's proposed. If you're on a particularly steep area, which a lot of places are, they'd be concerned about what kind of damage that fire might do to the road below. All those are quite localized decisions that are being made. And they would also be overlaying their own priorities, the Rural Fire Service and the council. So, for example, we saw up in the Bilpin area, areas that there had been hazard reduction in the past, and with backburns during the current emergency linked up past reduction patches, if you like, in the landscape with sort of new reduction of vegetation and fuel loads, which actually stopped the fire getting into the Gross Valley again, which could have threatened Katoomba and so many of those other places. So there's definitely a role for hazard reduction. But I've just kind of outlined, if you like, the technical difficulties at a very local level. How do you go about it? How does it fit in with the priorities of the Rural Fire Service? When you actually light the fires, you know, you've got to look at the weather models. Are you going to be, you know, cloaking the Sydney Basin in smoke, which is quite often the ideal time to be lighting these kind of fires? And at the same time, what resources have you got and money so that you can staff those fires to make sure they don't get away? All those things are part of the hazard reduction puzzle, which politicians are going to start to try to resolve in the weeks and months to come, particularly with the inquiries. But in some ways, the calls from a national level are really going to be filtered through the states.
I want to ask you both about the role of the Australian Defence Forces, because the Prime Minister has made it clear in recent weeks that by sending in the military to help deal with the aftermath of this, after a lot of criticism that they weren't there to help with that massive evacuation on the south coast of New South Wales, there is going to be some kind of ongoing role for the Australian Defence Force in dealing with this particular bushfire emergency, but also going forward. Peter, you wrote today about people looking at what that role might be. Are we talking about Australian soldiers fighting fires, or is it more sophisticated than that?
If you speak to people that have been in the military or retired, or in fact still are, the kind of words that they're telling us are along the lines of, look, we're not really set up to be boots on the ground, blacking out containment lines and actually putting out the fires directly. We're much better at the logistics. We're trained to do this. We can operate emergency communications, power units, possibly even law and order places. That's the kind of support that the military is often involved in, for instance, cyclone hit Fiji or Tuvalu or Kiribati, Papua New Guinea. That's often what the forces are doing. And so when we see ships heading off, helicopters, all the like, to assist our neighbours, I think a lot of people wondered, so why did it take so long for the reservists to be called up for the fires, say, in New South Wales and Victoria? You know, that could have been a sort of standby force. And the fact is, actually, for some years, the military, which are effectively the best scenario planners that the Australian government has, have been war gaming exactly those kind of combination of meteorological events, possibly an earthquake thrown in as well, to work out how they approach that. But it seems like, from a domestic point of view, that sort of preparation has not really been seen in public, but it's actually been going on for some years. And I think the inquiries that we're going to see that roll out, whether it's a Royal Commission and so on, will be to ask, like, if that work was being done, how come the federal government either wasn't aware of it, these ministers, why didn't they tap it? It seemed like there'd been a kind of dry run, including with some of the states. And I suspect we'll find out, for example, that post the Black Saturday bushfires in Victoria, that state has been more sort of tuned in, integrated with these war games, and it's quite possibly why they were the first to call for the military support and, in fact, got it.
My orders to the Defence Forces, as is communicated to the Chief of Defence Force today, is to ensure that they're standing ready to move and provide support to those communities as and when required, and to work, obviously, in close liaison with the state.
David, what are the implications for this? Are we looking at some kind of ongoing formal change in the posture of our military from external defence to some kind of internal role?
I think that there will be some formal changes. That's what Scott Morrison wants to canvass in a Royal Commission, and that's what he talks about in terms of a change in the arrangements between Canberra and the states in the mechanisms for calling out more military assistance faster. But hasn't it been so frustrating to see some of the slow responses when we know the capability has been there, but it hasn't been called in as quickly as it could have been? And I think that goes beyond the technicalities of the law that might be required to do that. We even saw, you know, doubly frustrating, the backgrounding by somebody in Morrison's government against the New South Wales government and the Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, about why New South Wales didn't formally call for military assistance earlier. So there's been real grief about all that political gamesmanship on this issue. But, you know, I think it's really important that the military support has been there for several months. It wasn't just called on New Year's Eve, but it could have been available earlier. The humanitarian assistance has really been key. That's where the military has excelled. I was impressed by the way in which HMS Jules, this big humanitarian ship, got down to Mallacoota so quickly. They were called sailors from leave. The question is, should those sailors have been on leave when this problem was, you know, months in the making and had been visible for weeks before Christmas and New Year?
Well, this investigation will take months and the implications of it will be over the decades. We have run out of time. I'm sorry. We could have kept talking about this for hours, but we will get back into it again next week. Thank you so much to our Please Explain guests this week, Environment Editor Peter Hannam from the Sydney Morning Herald and David Crowe, the Chief Political Correspondent for The Herald and The Age. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Subscriptions power our newsrooms, so to support independent journalism, search subscribe, the Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. If you've been enjoying this podcast, please leave us a rating or review on iTunes. This episode of Please Explain was produced and edited by Leah Samoglu. Amelia Maguire manages logistics and planning, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.